decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial X for the final stream tonight. And this is with Whiskey and Ashes. And I should say that he and I were in contact a long time ago, around about 2016, 2015, maybe even. And I wanted to do some sort of recording with him then, but it fell by the wayside for reasons I can't remember. And then we got back in contact once I got back onto Twitter, and I found him there, and so I wanted to invite him onto Millennial. So I did so, and he accepted. So I'm very glad that we're finally going to have a conversation that we probably should have had many years ago. So I apologize for that, and welcome to Millennial.
Oh, thank you very much. It is truly a tremendous honor to be here. Thank you so much for your invitation. And if Whiskey and Ashes is a bit much to say, you're welcome to call me Charles if you like. That's no problem at all. Whatever's easier for you, whatever you prefer.
Oh, that's handy. Well, would you like to introduce yourself to the audience?
Certainly. My name is Charles Spadil. I am have been in law enforcement, specifically United States Immigration and Naturalization, for many years. And then from there, I went into private investigation. I've written two books. One is called Whiskey and Ashes, An Inebriate's Avowals, Maxims, and Observations. The other one is The Holistic Guide to Suicide, which is to help specifically men deal with suicide ideation and depression and basically trauma in their lives. And it is not written from an academic standpoint. It is very much written from a man who has been through the long, slow death of his mother from cancer, losing his career, losing his fiance, and everything in between. So if you get a chance, I would humbly recommend you, and you have personal trauma or depression, suicide ideation, first, I would obviously recommend you get professional assistance. But if you'd like to check out my book, please understand it is not from an academic standpoint. It's from somebody who's been through it. Nobody is pointing down at you on high saying you just need to get over it. It is somebody trying to tell you, I've been here. You are not alone. As far as anything else goes, I've been a Manosphere author. My blog, 80 Proof Oinomancy, I've been off and on writing there for, goodness gracious, 12, 13 years. I'd like to think I've helped quite a few men through that blog and through my writings about social dynamics, sexual relationships, etc., masculinity. I've also appeared on the Pete Canonis show, an excellent fellow. Pete, he's a real fighter. I love him to pieces. And I am a founding member of the Thought Crime Syndicate, a regular feature on the Pete Canonis show. I'm honored to be there with such luminaries as Jose Nino, Pete Canonis, Dark Enlightenment, and as of recent, Stormy Waters as well. So you've probably, if you don't know who I am, I'm fairly certain you've encountered either my work or you've heard my voice somewhere. I have been called by Dark Enlightenment the Velvet Underground of the Manosphere, and I've also been called the Johnny Cash of the Manosphere. You may not listen to my music, but the musicians you listen to have listened to my music is basically the best way that I can put it. So hopefully that gives you all a vague idea of who I am and what I do.
Right. I mean, there are so many things that I could pick up on there, but I'll begin by asking you this: how would you describe yourself politically?
Well, again, this is why probably. Well, let me start. I would say that I am, like so many people, part of the libertarian to dissident right or alt-right, whatever term you choose to use. Pipeline. I would say that's definitely where I came from. I was strong libertarianly minded. And that's not because I came from an academic background. I didn't. My mother was a housewife, which I find that very respectful respectable profession. My father was a high school art teacher. So I certainly don't come from, if you'll forgive the phrase, an egghead background. I come from a very boots on the ground, sort of real world average Joe kind of background. My grandparents were all factory workers, but the era in which I grew up kept me from being in America, I would say as blue as the day is long. I couldn't be a Democrat because they have had an anti-white animus since I've been around, since as long as I can remember. And I'm roughly, I think we've established woes that I'm roughly 10 years older than you are. And yes, that's had an anti-white animus since I can remember, since I was politically mature, say 16, 18. And I would also say that I couldn't really be a Republican because obviously they always seemed like, if you'll forgive the analogy, a pro wrestling match to me. My entire political life, I've always thought American politics was pretty much a pro wrestling match. You had the baby face and you had the heel, but it was the same guy paying them both at the end of the match behind the curtain. And that's why I've always found myself an independent. In fact, I am a registered independent in the United States. So that's where I find myself politically at the moment. I always like to set people off by telling them that I voted for Donald Trump, but that's only because nobody offered me an even more right-wing candidate. And leftists love to hear that. Drives them absolutely crazy when I say that.
And yet you're not... let's say you have some sympathies with socialism.
I would say the best person that I could look to, and forgive me, Woz, I'm going to absolutely butcher this quote, so maybe some of your audience could find it more exact, but the Reverend Bishop Fulton Sheen had something that stayed with me ever since I read it. And I'm not going to get it exactly right. I should have memorized it before the program, but it's something along the lines of, be Christian enough to be a socialist in that you care about your fellow man and you want what's you want to see them well and to prosper, but be capitalist enough to understand that that everyone does have to, you know, bear their own cross and not be a burden on other people unnecessarily. I mean, I'm really butchering the quote, but it's along those lines. I don't view man as an economic being. I view him as a creation of God. And he has a certain level of duty and responsibility at that point, but he also has that to, you know, his fellow man and to the world at large. So I would say I have pro-social leanings, if that makes sense to you. I wouldn't necessarily politicize them as socialistic necessarily, but I would say I definitely have pro-social. To me, being a former government employee, a former federal law enforcement officer, to me, the purpose of a government is to serve its people. That's the purpose of the government. So to me, it doesn't necessarily have to be socialist or not. It just has to serve its people. It has to look out for the prosperity of its people. And I think that's the problem in which most of modernity find itself. Who are the people that the government needs to serve? It needs to serve whom exactly? And I think that's what we're encountering, is that every faction is trying to get the government to serve their own small community, whatever it may be, if that makes sense to you.
Well, certainly. But I also think that's a process that has been encouraged by the government. It's fostered my client groups. It's even imported them artificially. They wouldn't be there except for government actions, decisions. I think it wants that.
I agree.
Yeah, so it's a strange thing, because I think a homogenous, single, cohesive group would need the government much less. And so I think that's partly why it's been made less homogenous.
I would say that's correct by my experience as immigration, but I would say that your statement and mine aren't necessarily mutually exclusive, by which I mean, if I have, say, let's just pick a random number. Let's say if I'm 2% of the population and I want to make things more amenable to me and mine, well, then I would dilute the other larger groups so that way my 2% is larger by comparison. And I could also distract people from what I'm doing and moving things toward my benefit by causing infighting amongst the others. Whereas if I don't dilute the larger population, if I don't contaminate that particular pool, then I'm that much more noticeable, or it's that much harder for me to have influence since my numbers pale in comparison to theirs, which is why a multicultural society is always desired by those that are the occupational government.
Yeah. And of course, a smaller version of that is Amazon wanting a diverse workforce because they're much less likely to unionize. I mean, that to me is just such a giveaway that what all of this is actually about. at least for the corporate sector.
Yeah. I guess in keeping with the spirit millennial, I've always thought the best type of businessman is Mr. Fezziwig from Dickens, A Christmas Carol, because he's the fellow that still expects you to show up to work on time. He still expects you to do your job. He still expects you to carry yourself with a certain amount of decorum. He is pro-social. He treats his employees well. He has a party for them. He never forgets his place in the hierarchy. He is the employer. And again, I'm not going to presume that I fully understand the ins and outs of culture in the United Kingdom or its history. But I will say that I have always gotten the sense from that story that he has never lost his place in the social hierarchy. He is the class in which he was born. He is not ashamed of it. He does not try and downplay it. But he also does not belittle those that are beneath him in that hierarchy. He welcomes them. He understands their contribution and that he would not be in business without them. And that he looks at them in a very paternal or avuncular sense. And I've always thought personally, he is the ideal form of business in that he can be pro-social, but he can also be what he is.
It's the ideal leader. It's the ideal patriarch.
Yes.
Because it's someone who values the structure, but also values the people within the structure.
Well, he's also not a parasite. Let's be very clear here. Mr. Fezziwig, in the context of the story, is not a parasite. Oh, well, he's exploiting the worker. He is not exploiting them. He is trading money for labor. That's how the system works. None of them feel exploited. As a matter of fact, Scrooge himself even says, was there ever a kinder man? I mean, I'm leaning heavily on George Minter's Scrooge, the 1951 version with Alistair Sim, which is my favorite version, by the way. That's my all-time holiday movie. I watch it every year. But I'm leaning very heavily on that. So those of you that are literary minded, if you find me misquoting it slightly, please forgive me. Please bear with me. I'm going off of the adaptation. But still, he even says, was there ever a kinder man? I don't think an exploited workforce was there ever a kinder man? To go back to your statement, is there anybody that sits around in the Amazon warehouse and says, boy, that Bezos, has there ever been a kinder man?
I mean, it doesn't sound likely.
No, it does not. Most certainly does not sound likely. No.
No, it's a thing, isn't it, that for people in our position, I mean, I'm guessing that for people on the left as such, this is very simple. It's very straightforward. They just think that, I'm obviously talking in broad brushstroke stereotypes here, they just think that the person in charge of the factory is an exploiter and evil and selfish and all that, and bigoted as well.
Of course, can't leave that one out.
Yeah, but then for people in the mainstream right, they've got a more autistic sort of, it doesn't matter that they're poor, they've just got to do what they're told kind of thing. But yeah. Sort of monetarist, ruthless, hard-nosed capitalist, you know. I mean, I remember once seeing, because it sounds ridiculous when I say it like that, but I remember seeing an interview with Rupert Murdoch. At one point, I was watching a lot of, what was it called? Uncommon Knowledge. It was a sort of GOP neocon interview show. I've forgotten what the guy's name was. This very civilized looking, softly spoken guy, Peter something, I think his name was, and he would interview right-wingers, and he was interviewing Rupert Murdoch, and Murdoch boasted about screwing over his workforce by like a war of attrition, so that eventually they accepted terms that were even worse than they'd started with.
Oh,
and Lord. To him, that was something to boast about. That was something to be proud of. And and the host, Peter whatever, agreed.
Oh my gosh.
Like, well played. Oh, brilliant tactics. Oh. And I thought, that is, even then, because I guess that was during my libertarian phase, and even then, I thought, that's sick.
It is.
There's something wrong here. If this is where beliefs lead me, then I have to approve of this, then there's something wrong with my beliefs.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why I found myself to step back to the opening of the conversation. That's why I find myself drilling through the side of the pipe, as it were, the libertarian pipe, just drilling through the sides and, you know, okay, I have to get out of here, because if that's the end goal, I want no part of it. And what I suspect, and again, we're speaking very broadly here, but what I suspect, it's so egregious in America, because contrary to popular belief, America was not founded by immigrants. It was founded by colonists. It was founded by explorers. It was founded by those who built what is here today. There was nothing, there wasn't anything here. We didn't move in to all the Native American properties, and we didn't latch onto their healthcare system. None of that happened. We built it. And what I'm leading to go to your point about these parasites above. And I think the reason it's so rough in America with that, I think that the reason that attitude has become that, because so many people here fought and struggled to build something out of a wilderness. And that's noble. I'm not putting down my ancestors. That's noble. And I think that's to be lauded. But it does build a very individualistic outlook that is easily corrupted into screw everybody else as long as I get mine.
Yeah. Someone's correct. It was Peter Robinson. That was the name. I didn't want to say it in case it was incorrect, but yeah. Peter Robinson of Uncommon Knowledge. I mean, it's just awful. And you can understand then, if that is the attitude among right wingers, you can understand why people become left wing. Because yes, they see this and just think, well, this is inhuman. It's yes, horrible.
Well, because it is inhuman. It's inherently anti-human. And I think again, that's why it's the wrong path. And it's why when one finds oneself on that path, one really needs to reassess one's position. Because one can claim ignorance for only so long. And then the path before one should be patently obvious.
Definitely. I think this is part of, I've said several times that I think America was a more cohesive society 100 years ago than it is now. Yes. And part of that is this obsession post-1945 with money. I mean, I'm sure that Americans were always ambitious and
yes,
adventurous and so on. But I think that post-World War II, there's been this monetarist sort of hardline attitude, which certainly on with the GOP, but also yes, with the Democrats as well, to a smaller extent, which sort of tore the soul out of the country. And such that you then that naturally gives way to globalism and globalization, because if you don't care about the workforce, then, well, why not just replace them with Chinese sweatshop workers or whatever, or just offshore the jobs, because you don't owe them anything. There's no connection. It's not like Mr. Fuzzywig with his, he cares about his workforce. A completely different relationship, just a commercial transaction. So then you might as well get cogs that suit your purposes better.
Right. But the problem is that's the mindset of cancer and locusts, really. At the end of the day, I just need to grow. I need to grow and I need to eat everything around me. That's the mindset of cancer and locusts, to just replace these cogs, get something, you know, get something that feeds my machine. And I mean, that again, it's just inherently anti-human. It's just an awful philosophy. And I agree with you that the soul has been ripped out of this country. When you say it's less cohesive than it was 100 years ago, as a former immigration officer, I very much blame the Immigration Act of 1965 on that, because I think that our country was perhaps unconsciously, but I do think our country was an experiment of ethnogenesis, an ethnogenetic experiment, by taking European stock, largely English, obviously, from at the outset. But I mean, I could sit here and name a dozen other countries as well. But largely, it was an ethnogenic project that has long since gone off the rails. And by long since, I mean 50, 60, 70 years. Some, I'm sure, would say that it went off the rails with either the Chinese immigration, which I really wouldn't say that because I don't think it was significant enough throughout the continent to really make any kind of serious dent. Others would say that it went off the rails with the Italians and the Irish, which I would also humbly disagree with because, again, to have an experiment, you can't just have one thing. You have to have all these disparate elements in it to show what's happening, to cause a reaction, as it were. You need a catalyst. You need these things. And as somebody who grew up in the American Northeast, the Philadelphia area specifically, I can tell you that if you have friends in that area, they are either of Irish or Italian or both descent largely. And I don't think that was by accident. Some people will say, oh, because they were both the underclass in the early 20th century. And since they were both at the same economic level, they both got together. I think that's a trite answer. And while I don't think it's necessarily inaccurate, I think it is certainly incomplete. Because when you meet these people, when you meet people like people I've called friends for many years and I love very dearly, you find that those two communities, the Irish and the Italians, got together for a very important reason. And that was an inherently human reason, which is they bonded on a very deep level. Because at those communities in the United States, they valued three things from most important to least important on this list. They valued three things. They valued God, family, and friends. Now, one could drink and, you know, one could yell, one group was a slow burn, one was a fiery temper, but they connected on a very deep and human level, religious, social, and structural. And that's why if you talk to people, they'll be like, oh, my mom's Italian and my dad's Irish, or my dad's Irish and my mom's Italian. And as a matter of fact, I used to make the joke. I had this one boss in immigration in Philadelphia. I won't use his name, but it was the most Irish name you could ever get. And obviously he was born in the United States, but he was of Irish descent. It was the most Irish name you could possibly imagine. And he used to say that it was always a failure with women. And I said, well, who are you dating exactly? And he would name all these girls. He was only like 8 years older than I was. And I said, well, that's your problem. You're dating Irish girls. And he kind of like looked at me, like I imagine you and half your audience are looking at me. And I was like, well, yeah, that's your problem. You need to date Italian girls because they're different enough so that you'll find some spark there. But they're similar enough on a deep level that you'll work out. And I heard 5 years later after I'd left that he did marry an Italian woman and he's still with her today.
Wow. Yeah, there's always that thing about slightly different, but not so different that it creates problems, but different enough that it's sort of tantalizing.
A complementary difference. A complementary difference is what I would say.
Yeah. When I said that America was a more cohesive society 100 years ago, and I'm only speaking as a complete layman and outsider, but when I said that,
I wasn't alive 100 years ago either. So that's okay. Go ahead, please continue.
I wasn't actually thinking about diversity, about immigration. I was actually thinking about the social structure itself, because I think maybe I've got an idealized view of this, but I think in those days there had to be more solid, like inter-class solidarity, because people were simply more, they interacted more with each other. And life was a bit more precarious than it is now. So, I mean, we didn't have the systems in place that enable us to separate from each other. So there had to be more interaction, and therefore there was more respect. Because, and of course, otherwise, you know, some guy would just punch you.
Yes, that's the other thing. Yes.
That's the other thing. And I think it was that way in Britain. And I suspect it was that way in America as well. But I think an aspect of modernity has been to alienate not just individuals from each other, but classes from each other, groups from each other.
Atomization is what you're talking about. Yeah, atomization.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, would you say that America now is a society that is particularly marked by that, that it's that there is less solidarity vertically and horizontally than there was 100 years ago? What would be your impression of that?
I would co-sign that 100%, that there's a great deal less solidarity. Some of it I would attribute to technology and technological changes. Obviously, the internet and such, and being able to hide on your phone from everybody, being able to go on, you know, take the shot at myself, you know, going on to Telegram and talking to people that, you know, in other circles. You don't actually have to associate with people. And we struggle against that. As a matter of fact, you and your mod team were discussing that in the show prior about how people are moving a little too far away from in real life communication. So I don't think it's necessarily unique to America, but to return to the question that you asked, do I think there is less solidarity and more acrimony between the strata? I would say absolutely, because you're also dealing with a country that has been large enough to geographically separate as well as socially separate. I can just move into a new neighborhood with people at my economic level. And I do also agree with you. Forgive me, I'm going to be a bit scattershot here because I think your question has a lot of moving parts to it that need to be addressed. I really believe that a lot of this is interconnected in the sense of the technological changes, and then you have the post-Second World War move from a perception of, how do I say this, a professional perception of you're judged off of how hard you work rather than what type of work you do and how much money you make. Now everything in America is about how much money you make. And I do think that's a post-World War II thing, because I think those that run our occupational government are personally obsessed with money. And I think they have changed the concept of class into money, because they have money, but they don't have class. So they want people to be judged by their metric that they win on over than one that they lose on, because obviously everybody's going to choose the battlefield that suits their forces the best. So to continue back to what we were saying with the stratification and the disapparation of everything, I absolutely think things are less unified, less cohesive. And I think that's also because it's because of the obsession with money. I think that's because of the atomization due to technology. And I think it's because America, as a physical entity, as in the North American continent, there is enough place, enough room for us to move away from each other. If I don't like you, I'll move somewhere else. I can go to a different area. And I've long said that if I were ever to write a third book, it would be called The Land of America, Land of the Me, Home of the Slave, because we have just moved away from one another, and we have used tax brackets and local ordinances and HOAs as the new walls and moats that your countrymen did 800 years ago, 900 years ago, to separate from one another. And I think that's what we've done today too, much to our detriment. I mean, now understand, I'm not a pie in the sky individual. I think there will always be differences between people. I think there will always be clashes. But this complete lack of any type of social cohesion is doing no one any favors except perhaps Satan and his minions.
Yeah, I agree. I think, see, in this way, I do agree with those people who say that inequality, wealth inequality is a problem when it's extreme. I think when you have people like Bill Gates, George, Bezos, I've forgotten what his first name is.
Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos. I mean, they are rich in a way that right. The scale of it is just astounding to an ordinary right. person, you know? Yeah. They live in a different universe.
If I may, forgive me for jumping in, but if I may, if you take America or United Kingdom, whichever you prefer, think about how little money it would cost to buy every single representative in Parliament. Like, say you're Jeff Bezos and you have literally billions of dollars. You could buy every member of Parliament a house and you wouldn't even notice your bank account dwindle. And that would be the same in the United States. You could literally buy every representative, everybody, every lawmaker in the country at that level, at the federal level, a house, and you wouldn't even notice it. That's too much money. Like, as an American, that's too much money. Nobody should have that kind of money.
Yeah, and I realized that my choice of examples was quite biased, because I could have mentioned Elon Musk. I think the reason there's the obvious political reasons that he didn't occur to me, but also he actually seems a bit, in spite of being a bit autistic, he seems more down to earth and sort of real than like Jeff Bezos scares me, and so does Bill Gates.
Because, oh yeah.
I can't, to put it in the cliched way, I can't imagine having a drink with them. Whereas I can imagine having a drink with Elon Musk. And I'm sure that the odd joke wouldn't land properly. He'd misunderstand this or that. But I can imagine him just taking me on my own terms and we'd get along. I think we would have a laugh. Whereas these other two, I mean, I'd be looking for the zip up, you know, up the back of their neck kind of thing. I would feel in danger.
You'd be very tempted to grab their cheek and pull the latex off of their face for the lizard underneath, right? I say that obviously jokingly, but probably less jokingly than some might think, just if only slightly less joking.
So you see what I mean?
Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe Elon Musk is, you know, very detached, very disconnected from ordinary people. I don't know. But certainly those other two that I named do seem to be that way. And this is what I mean about the danger of obscene wealth. It does seem to, it carries this danger that basically they just come to look at the human species as...
Oh, that's Bill Gates.
Like bacteria.
Oh, that's literally, that's Bill Gates. That's with his obsessions with vaccines and global population. That's literally Bill Gates. And to step to your point and to prove and to support your point, Woz, I would say Donald Trump is the perfect example of what you're saying. That's why he's popular. Look at how much he's worth. It's easy to forget how much he's worth as monetarily. But everybody could see themselves... talking to Donald Trump. Everybody could see themselves sitting down and having a laugh, as you say, with him. For crying out loud, he filmed himself working at McDonald's for 15 minutes.
And the thing is, it didn't seem...
unnatural. It didn't.
Absurd. Yeah, it's like, I could imagine it would be hilarious. It would be fun to work at McDonald's with Donald Trump. I think it would actually make a shift at McDonald's quite enjoyable.
But again, to me, that has that Mr. Fezziwig vibe. Does he ever forget that he's a billionaire married to a supermodel? No. Let's be honest. He never forgets that. But does he treat you like you are some cog in a machine? No, he absolutely does not. For all of his flaws, and I am no... huge Trump supporter. Am I glad he won? Yes. He was the lesser of the two evils. Do I, much like anti-Dem, I don't think he can solve America's problems. I think it's too late for that without a whole lot of blood, but we'll leave that aside for now. But he is very much in tune with what I said earlier regarding Mr. Fezziwig. He does not forget his status. He does not forget his place in the hierarchy. He has fun with it. And in a way, he sort of lampoons it. Does anyone think Donald Trump is really working at that McDonald's? No, of course they don't. He took a couple photos. He threw some fries in a thing. He waved. But it doesn't matter. It's the fact that he did it and he wasn't too good to at least be self-effacing is what makes him beloved to so many. Whereas Bezos, could you picture Bezos or Gates doing it? No. They'd want to wear a latex glove and be 50 feet away from you. Don't come near me, you germs in shoes. I don't want you.
Yeah. It's a sick arrangement. And I do think it's very unnatural. I think it depends on massive prosperity. And I don't know. I mean, the big question is, for how long will this continue? For how long can this continue? As I say, it's a huge question. I just feel that this is something that should end, this era of obscene wealth, because it's as you said earlier, it's just not really helping anyone.
No, it isn't. And I would stand by that assertion. I think it needs to end. And I don't know what it, forgive me, I don't want to presume to know things about the United Kingdom that I don't. I try very hard to be that man that just sticks to what he knows to the best of his ability. So I'll speak from my side, and then you could sort of analogize for your audience. I live in the state of Oklahoma in the United States. It's pretty much the dead center of the continental United States. And there is a chain that sells ice cream and hamburgers, very American, called Brahms, where I live. And the purpose of my story I'll get to right now is, to me, that is the biggest you should be as far as a business. Because what Brahms can do is it serves the entirety of the state of Oklahoma and a little bit of the state of Texas. And that's it. That's what it serves. To me, that is the biggest size a business should be.
I agree. And here's one reason, just one reason why. It means that Oklahoma has something of its own.
Yes.
That's just one reason, right? Like the first thing that occurs to me. So yeah, I completely agree. So I interrupted there.
No, please continue. And what I was trying to say is I don't want to presume to know what an English or Scottish or Welsh equivalent would be. I don't want to presume to know what that would be. So you tell me for your audience. But to me, if you want to make $16 million a year, I'm okay with that. Like I'm not one of those guys that thinks if you make over $100,000, that's too much money. I'm very much in tune with, believe it or not, a lot of the air quotes robber barons of days of old, because many of them thought the lowest guy on the chain shouldn't make less than like 15 or 20 times than the highest guy on the chain. You'd be surprised at how close they wanted incomes to be. Again, I'm not saying they were communists or even socialists, but what I'm saying is even many of them would be shocked by the disparity that exists today. Like even they would just be like, what are you doing? So I don't know what an example for your countrymen would be, but for mine, I would say Brahms is the biggest you can get. If you want to make $16 million a year, great. You want to drive a fancy car, great. You know, you want to be able to afford the most beautiful women. And I don't mean prostitutes, but let's be honest, women gravitate toward money and power. So it's like, you want to be able to afford the most beautiful women. Fantastic. But you don't need more than, you know, 16, 20 million to do that. You know, you're fine with that. I think we can call that you've won air quotes capitalism. Okay. That's enough.
Yeah, definitely. And also that would, you could easily have a lot of children. You could easily send them to the best schools and they'd never need to worry about work in their life. I mean,
right.
Can't get much better than that. You right. don't, you know, beyond that, anything else is kind of ridiculous. But you know, any more wealth than that, but yeah, I agree. That kind of money is fine, but, like a billion a year. I don't really know why anyone needs to be a billionaire. I mean,
no,
it,
I'm with you.
It seems kind of crazy.
It seems insane to me. But then again, I mean, I've been through so much so that I require very little. And I am not the biggest fan of sitting here and quoting statistics and numbers and all that sort of stuff. But everything I have encountered in my life and everything I have read from stats and statistics to the actual writings of people in hospices, and having watched my own mother die of uterine cancer, I can tell you that I agree with the few studies that I have seen that state beyond a certain level, and that level being like you can afford shelter. I don't mean the best neighborhood, but I mean reasonably safe shelter. You can afford heat, you can afford food, you can afford water. Beyond that, your happiness doesn't change with money. According to many studies, and it doesn't really change beyond your basic life essentials.
Yeah.
If you have those, money really doesn't change who you are. You're either a miserable cuss, or you're a happy person, or you're somewhere in between. Now, prior to that point, if you are struggling to earn a living, which I'm not going to presume to know your history, but I strongly suspect you've had your times where you weren't sure where your next rent paycheck was going to come from, or, you know, if you had enough money for dinner, et cetera. Now, maybe
I'm in that position right now.
Oh,
so if people do want to support Millennial or subscribe to my Substack, I would really appreciate it. Just since you've given me that in, I thought I might as well just use it. It's true.
So, yeah, please. Yeah,
I have indeed been acquainted with that situation, and it's not nice.
No, I have been there myself, so no, I know exactly of what you speak.
Yeah, I think that you're right. That beyond that, it's the worrying about bills. It's the worrying about how are you going to pay the next rent. That kind of thing is shit.
Yes,
and 100%. Obviously, like, but beyond that, I can. Again, in the past, I've been in a position where I did have more money than that, and it doesn't affect your happiness. Because the thing is, weirdly, I mean, it's nice to have options, definitely, but beyond that, it doesn't actually make you happy, because your lifestyle, and this is the perennial problem, people have always said this, that your lifestyle changes just to suit your resources.
Yes.
So, and the other things don't change either, like your health, your need to do this and that, the obligations that you're serving, the people who are depending on you, the annoying things that you have to do. I mean, unless you're rich enough to have a butler who'll take care of a lot of this for you, then you've still got to do all that. You've still got to think about your health. You've still got to exercise. You've still got to do that annoying thing, that appointment or whatever. So life, I'm just agreeing with you, really, that money doesn't solve all these problems.
No, I think to kind of step back to our pre-recording conversation, perhaps you'll appreciate this. I think Bertie Wooster would be just the same individual if his trust fund dropped enough so that he was, you know, middle class. I think Bertie Wooster would be he would be the same guy. If he didn't have all of that money and everything, I think that character would be the exact same guy. Now, maybe he would change if he couldn't afford his gas bill, if he couldn't afford groceries. But I think he's going to be the same guy, whether he's, you know, lower middle class to whatever you would classify as he was in the P.G. Woodson.
Yeah, upper class, I would say.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think he would be the same guy, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it does. I don't know, because I can imagine people saying that his personality depends on his having had a certain upbringing, start in life. But I can see what you mean about his personality. It would just shine out of that. I mean, an example of this is Withnell, the character from Withnell and I, who has come from a very moneyed background, gone to one of the best schools in Britain, but now he's penniless. And yet he's still the same person. And it's the source of a lot of the comedy in that film, that he's still behaving and speaking like an aristocrat when he's, you know, basically impoverished.
Well, see, it's interesting. I'm going to use that as a jumping off point. And I'm going to say, I think that's one of the things. No, let me step back. That is one of the things that drives me crazy about America, is that we have an aristocracy, but they're just people with money. And as far as I'm concerned, money isn't what makes one an aristocrat. It's a bearing. It's breeding. It's a certain je ne sais quoi. There is something in you. If we want to boil it down, it is genetics that have been passed through your line, you know, due to selection, to biological social selection. Yeah. And I can't stand, I am not anti-aristocrat. I'm not, I'm pro-aristocrat. Matter of fact, I probably am a monarchist, if I'm being brutally honest, but I want an actual aristocracy. Just because you're rich does not make you aristocracy in my book, because I will say that my mother's father, who was a WASP, who converted to Catholicism for my grandmother. But I mean, my grandmother, my grandfather on my mother's side, I always called them American aristocracy, and they were lower middle class. probably much of their life upper lower class. But if you met them, they were always dressed beautifully. Now, maybe they were off the clearance rack of somewhere and you wouldn't know, but they were dressed beautifully. They were groomed flawlessly. The car was clean. They were always in it. My grandfather was always in a tie. My grandmother was always in a skirt, something always, but always, always something classy, always something respectable. And to me, that's what drives me crazy about America, is that they think money equals class. And it absolutely does not. It absolutely does not.
No, definitely. I think this is there's a misunderstanding between Americans and when they talk about Britain, that they think the class system is all about money. So it wasn't, and it never was, and it definitely isn't now either, especially because we're in this weird period just now where middle class, like the children, with the millennial generation, this change really happened, where the children of middle class parents end up less moneyed than their parents were.
Right.
So they don't have the same social standing that their parents had, and that they were raised to expect that they would have when they grew up. This is because the mass immigration, the obvious reason, but also that there just aren't that many jobs for people. You know, things change. And so you've got this situation where there are middle class people who are working at, you know, fast food joint or whatever. And then that is an interesting thing, because it leads, I think that leads very naturally into progressivist politics, because that's a way for them to be important. That's a way for them to, you know, it's like, well, okay, I'm not going to be a lawyer like my dad, but at least I can be part of Just Stop Oil kind of thing. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, actually. But yeah, the point is that the... there never has been, and definitely isn't now, a hard link between money and social class. It was always about manners, diction, how you spoke, education, and a general bearing. Yes,
carriage, yeah. How one would carry oneself.
Yeah, yeah.
If exactly. I may step back and show that I'm not a literary ignoramus, when I mentioned that Bertie Wooster would be the same fellow either way, I do understand that Woodhouse was poking fun at a specific section, a specific facet of English society. I do understand that. That was not lost on me. But what I was trying to articulate, and I am grateful to you that I think you saw where I was going with that, was that I think he would be the same bubbly individual had he been brought up in a lower class somewhere. Yes, I get that the character was poking fun at a certain thing, but what I'm saying is I think he, as that bubbly kind of absent-minded fellow, I think he would still be very much that mood,
yes,
that vibe, if you will, as the kids say, you know, that vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes, definitely. And he would probably be the assistant to a manager somewhere. And the manager would always be despairing of his assistant's absent-mindedness and dopiness and so on. Yeah, right. Exactly. He would still have that personality, yeah. But one thing that you wanted to talk about, and I was wondering if we would... segue into it fairly naturally, but it hasn't really happened yet, so I'll just bring this topic in. You wanted to talk about immigration and its effects in a world of universal suffrage. What did you mean by that?
Okay, well, and again, I can't speak for your country, but I'll speak for mine, and perhaps you can draw similarities from there. When you talk about universal suffrage, you talk about the political participation of anybody, you know, basically beyond a certain age, you know, man or woman, et cetera. Now, what I'm saying with immigration in a world of universal suffrage, that makes immigration an invasion, because you are giving me political power just by entering the room. That's it. By being able to breathe and show up to a voting booth. Heck, now with mail-in voting, I don't even need to show up to a voting booth. I can just sit in my house, fill out a form, and send it in. That is an invasion at that point. I don't need a rifle. I don't need a pistol. If we want to go back to the, you know, the medieval era or the Renaissance, I don't need a halberd. I don't need any of that. I just need to show up into your country and I have political power. Whereas 1,000 years ago, I would need to come over with a ton of my friends and kill a whole bunch of you and your friends. And then I get enfranchised. But now I don't need to do any of that. I just bring a busload of people into your area and now it's mine. And since we are air quotes democratic, I can make all of the laws favor me and mine. And perfectly legally as well. Why? Because the people have spoken. I am now the majority. I can do what I like in my neighborhood, which is why there are sections of Arizona where the Mexican flag flies higher than the American flag on City Hall. Why? Which is why there are entire neighborhoods in the United States where English is the second language. I have a friend, I can't use his name, obviously, who is an attorney in Texas. And recently, he needed a translator because he was the only one in the courtroom that didn't speak Spanish. So in a world of universal suffrage, immigration is a weapon. It is an invasion. Because now you are given political power simply by showing up. And that was one of the things I wanted to mention to you and your audience. And I suspect, I don't know how your system works. I have vague ideas of it, but I've never lived there. I've never dreamed, I've visited for extended periods, but I've obviously never felt so presumptuous as to participate in your political process. But I would presume that immigration would have similar effects in your neighborhoods.
Yeah, and this is how a government is able to affect, essentially choose a new, import a new electorate.
Yes.
Import a bunch of people who will vote the correct way. So if you give them the vote immediately or damn as soon as possible after they've set, you know, set foot on the landmass, then they're going to be indebted to you. Or whichever party it is that the powers that be want to get into power. So, I mean, assuming dark conspiratorial sort of systems there. So Pakistanis, Somalis and whatever, they're going to vote Labour. Mm-hmm. They're just going to. There's no ambiguity there. There's no uncertainty. But they are going to vote Labour. So the more Pakistanis and Somalis you have in the country, the better Labour is going to do in general elections, or all elections. So it's sort of like a dead cert. So if you want Labour to do better, you import more of those people. If you want them to do worse, you would deport some of those people.
Well, I think
it's incredible, really, when you think about it.
I strongly suspect, though, what Labour is going to discover, and again, this is just my supposition, I'm as an outsider, but if it's anything like what happens in the United States, I strongly suspect Labour is starting to, or eventually will, realize that they are not, in fact, voting for Labour. They are voting for free things. And they are voting for themselves. Labor will quickly find itself replaced by some sort of Pakistani organization, some form of Somali organization, some sort of Muslim organization, whatever flavor you want to give it. I'm not going to tell you how things work in your country, but I'm going to strongly suspect, and I'm going to posit, that they will find out within the next decade that these people are not, in fact, voting for Labour. Yes, I understand the current reality is votes are literally being cast for Labour. But that is, Labour is just the tool that they are using to enfranchise themselves. Once that tool is no longer useful or it begins to work contrary to them, they will throw away the tool.
Yeah, so Labour is using them as a tool, but they're using Labour as a tool.
Bingo.
So it's a classic case of the enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend. So Labour might think that these Pakistanis will help us beat the bigots, let's say, the white nationalists or the, right, whatever. Right. But and they will up to a point. But then eventually the Pakistanis, let's say, will realize, well, why are we kowtowing to Labour and going along with their nonsense like LGBT and whatever,
right,
when we could have, we're now big enough in the population, we're now predominant enough that we could just have our own party, and then we'll get what we want, and we won't have to do the stuff that we don't want to do.
Exactly, right. And that goes right back to my point about how in a world of universal suffrage, immigration is invasion, because they don't need to shoot anybody. They don't need to be violent. That's why I always laugh about everybody saying, oh, violent rhetoric is so worrisome. It's like, oh, you've already lost. Violence is the only thing that could probably save you. You've already lost the war, my friend. It's already over. And you gave it away. It's like, that's why I always just shake my head at some of these things.
Yeah, it's something where the country has been given over. And this also goes for every other Western country, really. The country was given over without a shot being fired. That's the cliche. That's what people always say.
Right.
But it's true. But the thing is that it was done without the agreement or consent of the natives. And indeed, it was done against their expressed wishes again and again and again.
That's the remarkable thing. Yeah, that we said prior to recording. I believe it, I forget exactly how I said it, but it was, I think it was very much along the lines of the irony is that all of these populist movements got completely ignored in the most democratic of ages. Once we brought in democracy, people stopped listening to the people. That just seems to be the bitter irony with all.
Yeah. Democracy is a tool. It's an instrument. It's really weird, actually, because on the face of it, you think democracy seems like, well, this is going to be the voice of the people, unfiltered, unmanipulated, unpersuaded, like uncoaxed, whatever. But actually, it's a perfect way to ignore the voice of the people, partly because whatever way the election, you can do all sorts of chicanery to get the electoral result that you want. Mm-hmm. But then, because it's a democratic result, you can say to the public, well, this is what you voted for.
Mm-hmm.
So this must be happening with your consent because you voted for this.
When in fact you didn't. One of the things I'd like to point out, and to me, again, in the United States, the 2020 election, what I like to say is that to me, the 2020 election confirmed a theory that I'd had for many, many years. And that is growing up in the Philadelphia area in the United States. I had a theory where certain communities, certain demographics do not, in fact, vote Democrat. I don't believe they do. And whenever anybody would come at me and say, oh, you're wrong. Look at all these studies. Look, I have thousands of papers and thousands of this and that. And say these communities, they all vote Democrat. Like these specifically, I'll just name them. The Black and Latino community, they all vote Democrat. And you're wrong. See, like, look, I have all these results. And I go, no, you're just seeing what they want you to see. What's really happening is these communities don't vote Democrat. They don't vote at all. It's just Democrats taking the blank ballots and putting what they want on it. That's what it is. That's why they've been bringing these people in. And that's why they've been doing what they need to do. Because you're talking about segments of the populace, and I'll put it charitably, that really are not very civically minded and civically engaged. They just aren't. They just aren't. It's not even a matter of my opinion. It's just a fact. And to tell me that suddenly once every 4 years or 2 years, depending what elections we're discussing, you're going to suddenly try and convince me that they're interested in the political process. That's absurd. That's patently absurd. Yes, I'm sure maybe, you know, a couple hundred thousand across the country or a couple million vote. But what I'm talking about is the vast rank and file are just blank ballots that the Democrats take and they fill in what they want and they put it out there. And as long as they give those communities what those communities want, nobody's going to complain. And that's how they've done it in Philadelphia. That's how they've done it in New Jersey. That's how they've done it in more states than I care to list on your program. Your listeners would be bored to tears if I tried to list everywhere where that's been done.
It seemed on that, because I stayed up for that election 2020, and I stayed up all night. And I did for the 24 one as well, actually. Mm. But in 2020, it seemed like there were just so many types of trickery going on.
Oh.
That were being reported in real time. I can't remember what the resources were that were reporting it, but it was different Telegram channels and different Twitter accounts and so on. And it was astonishing. I mean, it seemed like this is so corrupt, like the one yeah. that was like, and so brazenly, like, yes. openly corrupt.
Brazenly is an really, excellent word. Yeah, excellent.
The one that sticks out is when they were counting the ballots and they wouldn't let Republican monitors in, and they even put up boards so that they couldn't see what was going on.
I'm going to try and watch what I say very carefully, because again, I don't know the laws in your country. And so I watch what I say very carefully here.
All right.
Where Donald Trump lost my respect was when that began, when that pipe burst, air quotes, you know, and I'll use your word, because I think it is an absolutely flawless choice. When it was so brazen, where he lost my respect was it should have been martial law at that exact moment. This is obviously fraud on a level we have never seen before in the United States. And I choose my words very carefully there, Woz. I'm not saying there's never been chicanery or fraud in the American electorate. That would be disingenuous beyond words for me to claim. What I said was it has never been to that degree, or to use your word, that brazen. And where he lost my respect was it should have been martial law at that point.
And I remember there were some people who thought that he was going to do that.
And I will say this much, as somebody who took an oath to defend United States Constitution against enemies, both foreign and domestic. And forgive me here, I'm getting a bit passionate because I take this very, very seriously, but I will still watch what I say on the air. As someone who took an oath to defend the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic, he should have declared martial law. And barring that, if people refuse to obey orders, which looking back in the past, there was outright treason by General Milley, which we can talk about at a later time, or we could just skip over for now. But there's plenty of evidence that it would have gone nowhere, that he would have been disobeyed. He still should have gone on the air, whether it be Twitter, whether it be whatever press would show it, anything, and said, your country is no longer yours. Your country is no longer yours. I am being disobeyed. And if that means a Secret Service officer would step up behind him and shoot him, then he needed to take it. Because that is the oath you took. You wanted to be in that seat. You have to take the problems and the trials and the tribulations that come with it. And I do not say that as some armchair tough guy, Woz. I took the oath. I carried a gun. I wore a badge. I still carry a gun every day for my profession. I take it very seriously. If you want that kind of power, then you have to be willing to make that kind of sacrifice. I'll step off my soapbox.
Yeah, and I think that part of the cancer of our age is that men get office and they're not serious enough to take that oath seriously. It's just a formality. It's just something that they've nodded along to or whatever. But life isn't dangerous enough for them to think, this really matters. That like this, the wording here really matters. I'm actually the protector. It's all abstract. I think that this is also the case in Britain. I mean, people talk about democracy and duty and so on, but then they betray the country, politicians and so on. No one really seems to take it seriously anymore. Part of that is the caliber of men who get in. But even someone like Donald Trump, I agree with you that I wish he'd taken it more seriously.
Well, I agree. I think that is a problem. And I think you say it excellently with it, there that it is not taken seriously enough. I don't think people realize the gravitas in which many of these things, with which many of these things should be handled. They don't. And if I may, and I'm not being flippant in this, if I can bring it back to Mr. Fezziwig again, it seems kind of silly, but I'm very sincere. There's a scene in George Minter's film where the rapacious company man comes in and he says, oh, well, you know, if you don't do this and you don't do that and you don't, you know, act like a shark or whatever, then you're going to go out of business. Well, then Mr. Fezziwig says, well, then, okay, then I'll go out of business. Then if my way of life, if the world I live in fades, then I'm willing to fade out with it. I accept that. But I'm not going to usher in a new heartless, inhuman age. I'm not going to be part of that. And if I have to sacrifice myself, if I have to lose my business by not being a rapacious locust, then I'm willing to lose my business.
Yeah. It's a very sobering thing. I think that we have this, we live in this age now where, as I say, so much is abstracted, that, and there are so many systems in place that no one, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, I think people were able to reckon with the systems that were in place. They could deal with it. They could negotiate. They could conceive of it. I think part of the problem now is that Donald Trump doesn't know, how robust is the system against me? What will happen to me? Who do I need to fire, get out of the way in order to protect myself and my kids from retribution? If I don't toe the line, because it's just so big now and so clever, and the techniques are so much more advanced than they would have been 100 years ago.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that, and I one of the reasons, and I put this on Twitter, and I think the hashtag might still be out there. I actually had a little mini, very small tweet series named "Monarchy is Best Because." And one of the things I said is because a palace and a prison are the same thing. It just depends on what the outside people outside of it think of you. And that is, you know, one of the benefits of having a monarchy and an aristocracy that runs things are you are ultimately answerable. We know where you live. We know where you live. Whereas now everything is obfuscated. If you'll pardon the bit of a cliche term, but I'll use it. Now everything's obfuscated and everything's the deep state. Who do I blame? Who do I go get? I mean, I wouldn't even know who to talk to if I wanted to. Who? The CEO of United Health? I mean, I don't know where we go with this. Who do I choose? Whereas in these older systems, you know, we could all sit around the pub and say, okay, well, you know, the guy that lives in that big manor house up there, he's going a bit too far. You know, maybe he needs to be reminded that we're people too.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
And I'm not saying like I don't really believe that, you know, I don't really believe that people were ready to just, you know, take heads and such at a moment's notice. But you really did have the sense of if I have a serious problem, if our community really starts to go downhill, we all know who to look at. That's why I really don't like a lot of the propaganda that's been posited about all these cliched, oh, the evil king on the, you know, in the castle, the evil lord of the manor. It's like, you do understand that, like, there's 800 people to, like, him and his friends, right? You do get that. Like, if people really hate this guy, they're just going to go get him. It's not going to be that big a deal. So.
I think so. And this is what I meant about the technology wasn't there. Nowadays, you'd have laser tripwires and CCTV everywhere, facial recognition.
Yeah, right, exactly.
All of this that makes it so much easier to control people, to control the crowd, as it were.
Yes. Well, and also because you, and I'll say this as somebody that's worked in law enforcement, security, executive protection, investigation, It's less that those things exist. It's more that I'm trying to find the best way to phrase this. It's less that those things exist and more that I can show you the example that you're not going to get away with it. That's really what the difference is. And now some people may say that that what's the difference? They're the same thing. I would say that no, they're really not the same thing, because I'm putting, it's really more of a scare tactic. Like if I just say, hey, look, I've got this facial recognition and all this and I can get you. Well, okay. But first off, to kind of just boil it down, in order for security cameras to mean anything, somebody has to be looking at them. Somebody has to be watching them. Somebody has to be reviewing the footage. And you also have to have somebody competent enough to do that. And you also have to have a force competent enough to go get the people that are on that film, that are willing to go do it. You also have to have a community that's not anti-authority enough to let somebody go in. Because again, I won't speak for your country, but in mine, there are entire swaths of cities that are simply ungovernable. Fire departments don't go into it. The police department don't go into it unless there is something tremendously wrong. As a matter of fact, that's one of the open law enforcement secrets about the Jeffrey Dahmer murders. And I don't mean to seem like I'm pulling something out of the air, but it's very pertinent to this conversation. What nobody wants to say about the Jeffrey Dahmer murders is he didn't get away with them because he was clever. He was obvious. I mean, literally, a naked man wandered out of his apartment with a hole in his head. Like, why he got away with them was because his neighborhood was ungovernable. He was a white man in an overwhelmingly Black and Latino area, and the police wanted nothing to do with it. And that's why he got away with it for so long.
And that was in the 80s.
Yes. Yes. So all this is to say, yes, they have the trip wires. Yes, they have the facial recognition. But you live in a neighborhood that is still governable. And when people finally say, no, you're not coming into this neighborhood to get one of ours, it'll stop. And again, I'm watching what I say very carefully.
Yeah. Well, this is a sort of surprising thing about technology, that in the end, it does require to be implemented by humans.
Yes.
And so there's only so much, there's always a limit to how much you can automate it.
Right.
I guess AI is a threat, is a watershed here, because it means you don't need humans to watch the footage, for example. You could entrust that to AI to actually analyze the footage in real time. I don't know, but I'm guessing that's
a thing. That's true, Woz, but is AI going to come get me out of my apartment?
Yes.
Is AI going to kick my door in?
Yeah, exactly. So then again, you're still reliant on the human element.
Yes,
you can't automate that.
And was it who was it? Was it Solzhenitsyn? Who was it that wrote about when the communist gangs were first coming to get people? Was it Solzhenitsyn? Forgive me, I can't remember.
I think I know the quote that you're. Yeah,
where he said we should have just gotten fireplace pokers. And chair legs and firewood. And when they came in, we should have just beat the hell out of them, because maybe we would have lost. In fact, we probably would have lost, but their numbers would have dwindled and they would have been less and less willing to go down to the next neighborhood. If you're familiar with the quote that I'm.
I am. I know the one. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I know the one you're talking about. He's saying that, you should try to weaken the force rather than acquiesce to it or hope that it will get to you last or whatever. It's worth putting up a fight, basically.
Right, because, and again, that steps back to what we were saying moments ago about these men, they didn't take it seriously enough. And to say, I'll use a quote from The Lord of the Rings, the hour is late. You have to understand where we are now. I mean, I'd like to think we've been having a nice conversation and we've been, maintaining a sense of humor and we've had a couple laughs here and there, but we're both, I believe, and forgive me if I'm being presumptuous, but I believe we are both deeply serious men and we very much understand the gravity of the situation in which we find ourselves. We're just trying not to be depressing and, if you will, to use the term, black-pilled. You know, I try very hard on the Pete Canonis show to be very, if you'll pardon the expression, white pill, to be very positive, because I do think there are ways out of it. They are unpleasant. They are costly. But there are ways out of it. I don't think Alfred the Great got to just sit on his couch and just say, oh, things will work out.
No, of course not. No, I take the point. I think it's I would definitely consider myself to be serious about all of this and yes. cognizant of the gravity of it. But it's always a priority with millennial that I don't want to black pill at any time of the year, but I definitely don't want to depress people at this time of the year. So that's a thing. But yeah, it's that doesn't mean that we don't understand the severity of the situation. If that's quite the right word. Of course not. And I think everyone listening is the same. They probably wouldn't be listening if they weren't. Right. We all get it. It's a bad situation that we're all in throughout the West, unfortunately. Right.
And I think the real beauty of what you do here, Woz, I think truly the real beauty of Millennial, your project, is that it does let people know that there are other people out there that take this seriously. We don't have to just be sitting here with these dour faces and, you know, grumping at each other. We can still have a laugh and we can still be pleasant, but it doesn't mean we're not taking it seriously. And I think the beauty of this is it's a very hopeful project. If nothing else, if you accomplish nothing else, and I think you do accomplish a great deal more, but let's just be very, very conservative and say, if you accomplish nothing else here, I think the beauty of what you do is this. You let people know they're not alone. You let people know that there are other people out there that are concerned. I won't even say worried necessarily. I'll just say concerned, that they take it seriously and that they know that there are other people that see what they're seeing. Hey, I'm not crazy. Because I'm fond of saying, when it comes to socialization and friendships, women need quantity, men need quality. And I've tried very hard not to swear on your program, so, but I'm going to swear now. And it's, I really think a fellow needs some friends, just two or three good friends to look at and go, am I fucking crazy? Or is this neighborhood way different than it was when we were growing up? You know, you just need that touchstone to get through life.
Yeah. It's that sort of source of sanity. Yes. Reminder of things.
Excellent, which is excellent phrasing.
Yeah, and I agree, but it's it's a whole other thing with women. It's a whole different situation. But I don't know. I think you're right that men generally need fewer friends and get by with fewer friends. It's a strange thing, isn't it? Like in this day and age, we're constantly told that the sexes are the same, but. In all of these different ways, and that's just one of them, that it links to that thing about how women get like 100 compliments a day, but a guy will remember that time he got a compliment 5 years ago.
That's 100% true. 100% true.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, but that's a whole other topic that we could have gone into, and it was in your notes, but I think we should probably wrap it up now because this has been a very nice conversation and I've enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you very much, Woz. I'm tremendously happy that you did, and I'm tremendously happy to have been here. I really am.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm just sorry that I didn't invite you on sooner, but before now.
Well, tell you what, you can make it up to me by one way. We can chat again at some point in the not so distant future, not another 5 years.
Certainly. I would enjoy that. That there was one super chat, and this is from Dharma Initiate, and it's a very generous super chat. So thank you very much, Dharma. And she asks, what's the craziest thing you ever saw on duty? I don't know if you'll be able to answer this one legally, but.
Okay. All right. I can't say this is the. This is tough. Okay. No, I don't know what I can answer legally. So I'll tell you what, here's one that I can answer legally that I hope will be worth your super chat, Dharma. So I will say that I was an immigration officer in the Philadelphia airport at this point. And it's in the process in the United States, when you get off the plane, it was at the time broken into two parts. the individual, we'll use you as an example, Woz. We say you get off the plane from Scotland and you come up the runway here and you see U.S. immigration sitting in these booths. In the trade, it's called primary. And the purpose of them is to see you, Woz, and they say, okay, who are you? Why are you here? What are you doing here? How long are you going to be here? I'm sure you remember this process traveling here once or twice. I've no doubt.
Yeah, in 2016. Okay. Yeah.
Now, if you were specifically suspicious individual, you would be moved over to what's called secondary, where you go to another officer and that officer would try and get more answers out of you, do a little bit more investigation. And to see if you really belong here, if you're being duplicitous, et cetera. And I'm trying to keep this brief because I know you want to wrap it up, but I'm also trying to give Dharma her money's worth. I can't see the super chat.
No, don't worry about it. It's fine.
Okay, so I'm working secondary. This is the part where the deeper investigation happens. So I'm working secondary, and I see this fellow being moved, guided from primary, over to my area, secondary. And he's this Asian man, I presume Vietnamese, Laotian, something like that. It's been, 26 years, 28 years, I can't remember. But as a shorter Asian man, about 5'8". And he's walking up to me and he has this vest on. And it's like just a tan vest and it's got a dozen pockets in it and everything. And he comes up and I can still see it in my head. He's got the black hair and he's got the Asian features. And he obviously doesn't speak English. He kind of starts jabbering. And I don't even mean that in a racist sense. I mean, he just like very excited. He's not speaking English. And he comes up to me and he starts jabbering. And I'm like, sir, just wait one moment. Hold on. We'll help you. And I'm looking at him. He's got this vest and it's just packed full. And then he starts reaching in the vest and it starts slowly unzipping. And for some reason, my mind just starts going, that's a bomb. That's a bomb. It's going to go off. And I remember clearly looking at this little roughly petri dish size of paper clips and thinking, if the bomb doesn't kill me, it's going to shoot one of those through my skull at 1500 feet per second. I am dead. I just haven't realized it yet. And just everything just goes quiet. And I just have this overwhelming sense of calm. Like, okay, I'm going to meet my creator. This is it. And then he finishes unzipping his vest and he pulls out paperwork for asylum.
Oh.
Dharma, I hope that was worth your super chat.
did you visibly sigh with relief and thank him for not carrying a bomb?
I did. I'm sure I visibly sighed for relief, but when you're in law enforcement, you learn to try not to tip your hand about that kind of stuff. But I'm sure that it was on my face. I have no doubt. And when we have another time, I will talk to you about my meeting Ray Park, the fellow that played Darth Maul in Phantom Menace and did the stunts in Sleepy Hollow as the Headless Horseman. If we speak again, remind me, I'll tell you that story as well, because I think that's another good one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw that film at the cinema. Sleepy Hollow, not the Phantom Menace. I've still never seen the Phantom Menace, actually.
You've missed nothing.
All right, yeah, that's what I've been told. I've only watched the second, like the ending of the third film, because I wanted to see how they did the transformation from Anakin to Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. I was curious about that. But other than that, I've not seen anything of the prequels. But I am increasingly curious about them, because some people say they're actually really good. You've just got to go into it with an open mind, you know?
I can't say I've seen it. I think I saw Phantom Menace and I walked out. Oh, no, wait, I did see Phantom Menace. And then I walked out and then I wrote like a 3 or 4 page legal pad treatment on how I would have done the movie, because I've written like 2 or 3 screenplays. So I did a whole treatment. I was like, I hated this. And I got so angry, I just wrote my own and I never showed it to anybody, but I did it.
I do remember that there was a great big disappointment, especially with The Phantom Menace. I think when that came out, there was huge expectation and then everyone was disappointed by it. And then I think the second and third got a better, slightly better reception. But I then you've got the new ones, and I've only seen the first one again, the Force Awakens, and I just thought that was rubbish, total rubbish.
Probably was.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
While we're speaking of entertainment, let me say very briefly. I stand by my assertion. John Pertwee was the best Doctor. I'm gonna get everybody to hate me, but John Pertwee was the best Doctor, and I'm also gonna say that Blake Seven, to me personally, I missed it when, I believe his name was Gareth Thomas, left the role as Blake and Paul Darrow took over as Avon. So
yes,
I know the writing got better, but I would argue that, you know, that's just because, you know, Terry Nation and the gang were getting more and more practice and the characters were finding their voices. I think it was the actor's name, Gareth Thomas, the fellow that played Blake.
Yeah, Gareth Thomas.
I think he brought a quiet charisma to the role that I really, really missed when he left after the second season.
Well, look, I agree. I wouldn't say the writing got better after that. There are four seasons in total, and he leaves halfway through. Okay. And then it's Paul Darrow. And Paul Darrow's fantastic, and I love Avon, the character.
Yes.
But yeah, definitely misses Blake, because without him, he's the heart. You know, he's the driving force, and it doesn't recover without him. There are some good episodes. There's one good episode in the third season, Rumours of Death, and then in the fourth season the first half of it's rubbish, and then the second half of it's good, and it ends with the finale.
Yes.
It's just one of the best episodes out of the whole thing.
Yes. A legendary ending to a television series too.
I don't want to. Don't. Let's not spoil it for people.
But let's not spoil the 30-year-old TV show for people.
40.
40. Excuse me. Oh God. Thank you, Woz. I appreciate that.
That's a whole thing that I could talk about in great depth, but I won't do it. I'll just
say. What's the line in the one episode? I'm sorry. What's the line? I loved it when it's Blake and Avon going back and forth and one another. I'm going to mess it up. I should have written it down before I came on your program, but it's something like Blake is telling them, okay, you have to go down and do this thing on the planet or whatever. It's long after they've gotten the Liberator. And he says something like, I'm not your lackey. I'm not expendable. And I'm not going. the writing is so sharp. And it's just the two of them. Oh, it's just. One thing always loved about British television is this is going to come out very disparaging, and please forgive me. I don't mean it disparaging. I mean it perhaps to backhand a compliment, but I mean it very seriously and with all the love in the world. They don't really go for the best looking people generally, but there's the chemistry between the actors and actresses is so often just exactly what makes the program. As Time Goes By with Dame Judi Dench, and is it George Rush? Who's the fellow that plays the man in that series, if you're familiar with the series?
Hold on a minute. I'll just find out.
He's a famous English actor. He's been around.
Oh, Jeffrey Palmer. Yes.
Jeffrey Palmer, excuse me. Just the chemistry is so – that's one thing I've always loved about British television. Like the chemistry between so many of these performers is just what makes the program. And it was Gareth Thomas and Paul Darrow, just that – oh man, like how could you not enjoy it? Like, oh, it's just so well done, so great.
Yeah. I agree. We should maybe do a stream where we sing the praises of Blake Seven, because it's still, well, that it was my favorite TV show for many years. Mm-hmm. Then I saw a program called Manhunt from 1970.
Mm.
And that sort of became my favorite one, but it's kind of similar to Blake Seven in the sense that you get very highbrow dialogue and sharp remarks like that. Mm-hmm. But it's also fast paced. It's got like sort of pulp storyline kind of thing. And so it's exciting and fun, but it's also stimulating. You know, it's thought provoking, dare I say. So I love Manhunt is. Yeah, it's like an even lower budget Blake Seven set in Resistance France. It is available in Region 1. I've recommended it to people before. Manhunt 1970. It's a wonderful program. But Blake Seven also is great. But anyway, we can talk about that some other time in a more long form fashion. That'd be great. Actually, on what you said at the start, John Pertwee, he is my second favorite Doctor.
Is Patrick Troughton your favorite?
No. Sylvester McCoy, because that was the one that was the Doctor when I discovered the program. And okay. You know, it's always true about, you know, your Doctor is your favorite one is the one that was there when you discovered it. And yeah, so I'm accustomed. That's my sort of default thing is late 80s Doctor Who. And so yeah, Sylvester McCoy is my it means a lot to me. It was a big part of my life at that time. But John Pertwee, the early 70s, yeah, it's just charming. It's just a charming program at that time. So again, I would. It's its own thing. An acquired taste in this day and age.
Yes.
But yeah, it is charming. Anyway, let's leave it there. This has been a very fun conversation, so I'm really glad that we did it.
I'm thrilled.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Hold on a second. Let me just see who's on tomorrow. Okay, it's Martyr Maid, Daryl Cooper, then Will Tanner, then Herd Immunity News, who's some people will be familiar with him. I think he's Scottish. And then finally, Black Pilled. So that should be quite a night. That's going to be quite a night indeed.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So, there we go. I'll be back for that. But in the meantime, Charles, Whiskey and Ashes, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you for having me. And thank you, listeners, for those of you that listened. And have a blessed Christmas and a wonderful evening.
Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. But how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner. And only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.